Many times in history, we observe how the discovery of a single fact has often changed the entire course of the human race. Such things as simple things like the discovery of the wheel. That was discovered thousands of years ago, and yet it still remains as the basic principle of physics today. The discovery of the printing press and how it revolutionized the entire educational process. Copernicus' discovery of the expanded universe that pushed the boundaries of our knowledge way on out past where we were before he discovered that great principle. Or you take the discovery of electric and atomic power and the great manifold blessings that have come, as well as responsibilities, but nonetheless we've been brought into new eras, into new eons, because of the discovery of these great physical, educational, and things of the universe that affect our lives in such a very broad way. Now, all of these things are facts. We don't question them today, those of us who live in a civilization such as ours. Whether you accept these or not does not at all determine whether or not these things are realities. They are realities. They exist. They are truths, whether you accept them or not. Our acceptance has nothing to do with their reality. But can you imagine for just a moment how backward we would be and how in another age altogether we would be if we were to be living today unaware of the printing press or unaware of the wheel or unaware of the expanded universe or unaware of any of these great principles? Think about it. Can you imagine it? You won't really have to imagine it. I can cite you an example of it. In the Philippine Islands in 1971, a man discovered a small tribe of people numbering only 24 people. They were known and are known today as the Tassaday tribe. They are virtually a Stone Age tribe of people living in the 20th century. The only tools they had were stone tools. They had no implements past the stone axe that they used as an implement of agriculture. But they are living in a 20th century age, an age in which we know about electricity, we know about the printing press, we know about the wheel, we know about all of these things, and yet they knew about none of them until 1971. And if you could see the squalor and the filth and the disease-ridden conditions in which they lived, it would probably turn your stomach and would be revolting to your very understanding. You couldn't comprehend it. Now, the death and resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth is like one of these great principles that we've mentioned a moment ago. It's one of those single facts, the discovery of which causes us to never be the same again, the discovery of which causes our entire course of our human life to be changed into a different channel. The death and resurrection of Jesus is of such a stature that it has turned the entire course of the human race. And yet there are millions of people today like the Tassaday tribe of the Philippines, who live oblivious to the fact that Jesus of Nazareth ever was raised from the dead. I'm not sure that I have helped alleviate that problem at all, because in times past I've said on many occasions that it is difficult in any age to comprehend and believe in the resurrection, because the resurrection lies outside our everyday human experience. But I want to ask you this morning, is that right? I've said it over and over again, but the longer I live and the more I search and the more I see, I'm coming to the conclusion that that simply is not true. We do not live in a time, we do not live in a world to which the resurrection is a strange oddity. I'm more and more convinced that we live in a civilization, we live in a universe in which the death-life cycle is something that permeates our entire human existence. I'm convinced that the death-life cycle is actually that which is the theme of the human experience. I do not believe that you can turn to any phase of our human existence that is not governed and regulated by this death-life cycle that I'm referring to. It becomes the background. It becomes the tapestry of our whole life. It becomes the unifying theme. This death-life cycle becomes the common denominator that relates all of life to itself and brings it around one common theme. The theme of death to life permeates our entire human existence and allows us to come then to some understandings. and to come to some faith. And consequently, having come to faith, we can come to life and begin to see how life fits together and how all of it is centered around this one great theme of death to life. And so I wanted today, on this very great occasion of our Lord's resurrection, the Lord's Day, the first day of the week, I wanted to call to your attention for one reason only, really. All I want you to see today is that the resurrection of our Lord Jesus Christ is not something that's outside our experience. It's something that is absolutely a part of everything that you do. All of your human experience is related to this one central theme of death to life. Now let me give you some illustrations of it. In nature, this death-life cycle is unending. It's all pervasive. It goes all the way through every aspect of our lives. For example, in Genesis, the 8th chapter, and verse 22, the writer there records the statement of the Lord when after the flood he said, as long as the earth stands, day and night, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, winter and summer shall not cease. All of these things he mentioned as examples of how, even as a part of the creation, God arranged for it to be so that all of life would center around seed time and harvest, day and night, summer and winter, cold and heat. This is simply God's arrangement of things. In John the 12th chapter and verse 24, Jesus referred to it as a life principle. He said, unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it abides by itself alone. But if it dies, it bears much fruit. And in 1 Corinthians the 15th chapter, the Apostle Paul acknowledges this as surely as Jesus acknowledged it. And he said, O foolish man, do you not know that what is sown does not come to life unless it dies? And so he talks about this same death-life cycle. Now let me give you some illustrations of it in our everyday life. How many of you have ever fished for salmon, perhaps, in the Pacific? The salmon has something built into it that causes it to recognize the death-life cycle. I remember standing on the banks of many of the rivers in New Zealand, fishing for salmon, and we would watch those salmon that every year the salmon runs would begin. You know where they were running to? They were running to their spawning grounds where they had been born perhaps 2 or 3 years earlier before they matured as just little baby fish. They had been spawned there or had been born there and had been laid there by their parents. But what happens then when these fish mature, they go back up to that same position, that same river, the same bank, and there they also spawn. And you know what happens when they spawn and bring life to thousands of new fish? The mama and daddy fish die. They just simply die because of this cycle, this death-life cycle. It's built into them too. Did you ever hear about 7 o'clock on summer evenings this grating noise of these bugs up in the trees? And that may not be the proper name for them, but the cicada fly. Did you ever hear that gritting, grinding, ear-splitting noise? You know what that is? That's the cicada fly. It comes to life every 17 years. It lies in the ground, dormant, in an egg form, until on its 17th year, at the call of God, it emerges from the ground, comes up onto the trees, it there becomes a mature fly, and then issues this call by grating its wings together, and the mates call each other together. They then breed, they then lay their own eggs, and as a result of this, then they die shortly after that, and it perpetuates this cycle of death to life. It's there too, you see. Every one of you who came here today, myself included, we all went through somewhat of a dress rehearsal of this death-life cycle in the universe, in our human existence. You went through this dress rehearsal last night as you lay down and stayed there for a period of maybe 3 or 4 or 5 or 8 hours. And that's about all I got last night. But you know what you were doing? You were experiencing a dress rehearsal for that great awakening day, and the sleeping that you did last night was symbolic of death. When you woke up and opened your eyes this morning, it was symbolical of what you're going to experience in the great resurrection day. All of this, you see, there's nothing strange about that. We go to sleep thinking nothing of it. We wake up thinking nothing of it. We listen to the cicada fly thinking it's amazing, but don't really understand the implications of it. We see the salmon return. We see all of these things. And then we see the little worm, the caterpillar, and we watch that caterpillar spin its own shroud around itself and go into a type of death.
and it lies there dormant until all of a sudden, through a metamorphosis that defies the human concept of what can be, and out of a metamorphosis, this that was simply an ugly caterpillar emerges out of this death shroud into a butterfly that soars above its former environment. Now we see all of that, and we know all of that, and though we don't understand it, we accept all of that. Now what I'm saying today is simply this. That has got to have significance. The collective impact. Do you know what your great-great-great ancestors thought about all of that? They didn't understand it either, but they began to sense something. They began to sense that something was astir in the universe, and that they were a part of some great design that they didn't have any part in planning, but they had a very much a part of executing. They were involved in something. And this great awareness began to dawn upon them that the whole of the human existence is patterned around this death-life cycle. And consequently, it began to show up consistently in their religious rituals, their religious rites, and their religious writings. Job mentions it in Job, the 14th chapter, and says, as he saw a tree cut down, and he thought about that which he saw. Listen, he says, for there is hope for a tree, if it be cut down, that it will sprout again, and that its shoots will not cease, though its root grow old in the earth, and its stump die in the ground. Yet at the scent of water, it will bud and put forth branches like a young plant. But a man dies and is laid low. Man breathes his last, and where is he? As waters fail from a lake and a river wastes away and dries up, so man lies down and rises not again till the heavens are no more. He'll not awake or be roused out of his sleep. Oh, that thou wouldst hide me in Sheol, that thou wouldst conceal me until thy wrath is past, that thou wouldst appoint me a set time and remember me. If a man die, will he live again? All the days of my service I would wait till my release should come. Do you see this that's bound up in man, this desire for eternity? Do you see him as he looks at the earth, at the tree, and says, look, even a tree, as insignificant as a tree is, even it has some hope after having been cut down, that just a little water upon it will cause it to bloom again. What about a man? If a man die, shall he live again? Not only Job, who predated all of Jewish history. Job's writing is not a Jewish writing. It predates Jewish writings. And it comes to be more of one of those writings of the ancient religions, though God incorporated it into the Bible and put it here for our learning. And he was the one that was living with Job and gave him these insights, and Job wrestled with him, and God had it recorded so that you might know what the cycle of life is, that where life really makes sense. But our ancestors, who didn't have this revelation from God as Job did, and who didn't have that which God provided for Job, watch what they began to do. They began to wrap maypoles. That's right. They began to take little strings like we'll do over on campus. And if you want to see an ancient rite that originated with heathen, that's right, your heathen ancestors, you want to see a replay of that, go over there about 6 o'clock in the morning and you'll see these girls wrapping that maypole. You know why they do that? Because in the ancient people's minds, as they saw God, or as they saw nature, wrapping her creation every year with new leaves, with new flowers, they began to symbolize that as they decided, we'll wrap something too. So they got these multicolored strands and began to wrap them around a pole so they could be a part of the recreation also. And then they have the spring rites. They have what was known as the Easter rites. Yes, all of this, you see, came up out of the consciousness of man as he began to look around and see how the whole universe was arranged around this death-life cycle, and he couldn't understand the full implications of it, but he knew that he was involved in something that was as real as life was real. And then all these new frocks that you've got on today. Man, you look like a bunch of blooming flowers. Blooming, fresh. Some of you look like daffodils and buttercups. The yellow, this lady, that's right, dear, you look like a brand new buttercup. But you know where that originated? Not with Fifth Avenue in New York. Fifth Avenue in New York had nothing to do with the origination of this. This originated way, way on back in our history of human beings, when people began to see how that nature reclothed her creatures in something new every spring. And then man began to say, by the way, I want to have a part in that too. A woman did. Man hadn't had much to do with it, frankly. But the women, by the way, they go and deck out in something brand new every spring because of the fact that this is just a part of the death-life cycle. And the collective impact upon the ancients was so significant that it permeates so much of their religion, so much of their social practices. And we today are a part of that same fulfillment of it. We're a part of the same practice because we are a part of the human race. And the death-life cycle is that significant in our history and in our consciousness. Now listen, then there came a time in the fullness of time, on the heels of all this that nature has done, and on the heels of all the implications that men drew from these things in nature and began to implement them into their religions, there came in the fullness of time one who by his very life brought us the real meaning of the death-life cycle and showed us what it meant. 1948 years ago today, that's not speculation now, that's fact. 1948 years ago, this very morning, some strange reports began to come in, astonishing and frightening. One woman ran back into the city of Jerusalem and said that the grave of her friend who had just died was empty. Someone had taken his body and she didn't know where they had put him. Two or three other ladies came running into the same city saying that they had also seen the empty tomb and that they had seen angels who said that this man is not any longer dead. Still others ran in astonishment from the tomb and with sheer fright at having seen these messengers, and they ran pell-mell back into the city and were interrupted by this very one Jesus. And they saw him and they went up and says they took hold of his feet and they worshiped him. Still others, two men on their way to a little town 12 miles north of Jerusalem called Emmaus. These two men walked for some 8 or 10 miles with this stranger. And their hearts began to burn inside them. Something strange was happening. They didn't quite know what. And he was made known to them in the breaking of the bread. And they realized that Jesus of Nazareth is not dead any longer. He's alive. And all these reports began to filter in. Strange, conflicting, yes. Until by the end of the day, the minds of these people were just spinning. Their hearts were on the point of bursting. And their minds were in such a tangle and a turmoil and in such a feverish pitch because of this knowledge that was newly attained and had not yet been assimilated. They couldn't grasp it all. And they stood there perhaps flushed and feverished and excited to the point of being nervous, to the point almost of fainting. And then there came into their midst this one who said, "Why are you troubled? And why do these questions arise in your mind? It's I. Come and feel of me. See my hands and my feet." He said, "A spirit doesn't have flesh and bones as you see me have." And it said, "While they still disbelieve for joy, he said, 'Do you have anything here to eat?' And they brought him a piece of broiled fish. And he ate it in front of them. And then he said to them, 'Now I told you while I was still with you that all the things written in the law of Moses and in the prophets and in the Psalms must be fulfilled in me.' And then he opened their minds that they might understand the scriptures. And he said to them, 'Thus it is written that the Christ should suffer and rise again from the dead the third day, and that repentance and remission of sin should be preached in his name among all the nations, beginning from Jerusalem.' And he said to them, 'You are witnesses of these things.'" In the mouth of a man who was a disciple of this Jesus, some 20 years later perhaps, this question was posed to a judge. "Why do you think it incredible that God raises the dead? Why do you think it incredible
that God raises the dead. Listen to me. All of nature shouts there's a resurrection from the dead. Are you not smarter than a cicada fly? Are you not smarter than a tulip bulb? Are we not having more intelligence than a salmon? Can we not get locked into this reality that there is a resurrection? Must we forever live like the Tassadays, who live oblivious to some facts that would have brought them up into the present age of power? Must we also live oblivious to the reality of the resurrection of Jesus Christ? And yet there are millions upon millions of people who are living today oblivious to the fact that nature shouts out and says there is a resurrection. Open your eyes. Open your ears. See all around in nature that there is a resurrection. Realize that what you did last night was a dress rehearsal for the great resurrection day. You slept and you've now been raised to this new day. Realize that all of this man's teachings, Jesus of Nazareth, all of them centered around one reality that he expressed in John the 14th chapter when he said, "Let not your hearts be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me," he said. "In my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not true, would I have told you that I go to prepare a place for you? But if I go and prepare a place, I will come again and receive you to myself." His entire life was centered around this death-life reality. He told his disciples, recorded in Matthew the 16th chapter, thus he says, "It is necessary that I go to Jerusalem and there suffer many things at the hands of the elders and the chief priests and the scribes. And they'll spit upon me and I'll be put to death and I'll be raised on the third day." He said this is the reality of his existence. And then later on in verse 24, Jesus said to his disciples, "If any one of you, if any man would be my disciple, he also must deny himself, take up his cross and follow me." So he said, this is my lifestyle. I'm going to have to die. I'll be buried. I'll be raised. He said, this is your lifestyle. You must also die. You must be buried. And you must be raised. And so we come to the realization that this is the entire gospel of Jesus Christ rolled up in one very familiar nut. Rolled up in one very familiar shell. What is it? It's the same death-life cycle. The death-life cycle of the cicada. The death-life cycle of the salmon, the death-life cycle of the centipede or whatever, the cocoon as it bursts into the new butterfly, the death-life cycle of sleep, the death-life cycle of everything, the death-life cycle, yes, of Jesus, who died, who was raised to a new life. That same death-life cycle is imposed upon you if you're going to live today instead of just dying and wasting your life. Now listen, here's all I want you to see today. I want you to be impressed with the fact that the resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth is so much in tune with the entire human existence that you'll have to be blind as a bat to not see that this whole thing is wrapped up in the reality of life and can be expressed in three words: a death, a burial, and a resurrection. And that those are the most natural experiences through which God could bring us as he brings us into the new age. How is he going to do it? He did it through bringing his son to death for us. He did it through burying that one in a grave. He did it then 3 days later by raising him from the dead. It's not outside our human experience. It is the very essence of our human experience. And then he calls us to this same dying to selfishness, this same burial of our old nature. And like the butterfly emerging out of its cocoon, we are coming out then into a new life that's in harmony with the whole creation. And yet millions live today as though he never was raised from the dead. There are hundreds of us here today perhaps who are living in doubt, who are living in uncertainty and guilt, who are living in anxiety and in fear as though Jesus never were raised from the dead. How many of us here today don't really and truly live free of guilt in the sense that we can live as a reborn, newly created son of God? How many of us don't live free of anxiety, but spend our lives burdened under guilt and the burden under the weight of anxiety and fear? And all this that threatens us as we approach death, how many of us live as though Jesus was never raised? Then we're no smarter than the Tassadai tribe of the Philippines. And someone, perhaps me or someone else, needs to come in and discover this little tribe of people who've not yet discovered the reality that can turn their entire human existence into a different channel. That's what Jesus wants us to understand. And so he comes to us saying, why are you fearful? And why do these doubts arise in your heart? It's I. He's raised from the dead. And he calls us. What are you going to do with him? Will you insist on going on living in your jungle? Will we insist on going on living as though we were just simply oblivious to his resurrection? Or will you believe it? Listen, we're all like a grain of wheat. You came here today as a grain of wheat. You know you've only got three possible destinations waiting on you. Number one, like a grain of wheat, you can be poured into a trough to be devoured by animals. That's what happens to wheat. That's one of its futures. It can be poured into a trough, and pigs or cows or horses come and they, by their animal passions, devour that wheat. You can be like that. Or you can be like some other wheat that someone takes and through the grinding stone of adversity and hard knocks and all, that's ground up into flour and made into bread, and it becomes at the disposal of human beings as they break open the bread and we become the victims of their will. Wheat is like that. That's the destination of some wheat. But then there's a third destination, and that is that wheat can be replanted. It can die, and it can then be resurrected through the harvest or through the spring and be harvested and bring forth a thousandfold in a new form of existence. That's one of the destinations of wheat also. Which will you be? You're a grain of wheat this morning. You can either become the victims of your own passions, your own animal desires, and you can let your wheat life, you can let that which is your core be eaten up with animal desires, or you can be ground into the earth through adversity and the stones of hard knock, and you can be then ground up and made into bread for somebody else to eat. Or you can simply die as Jesus died, be buried as he was buried. And as he said, unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it'll abide by itself alone. But if it dies, it bears much fruit. That's what he's calling on you to do today. And that simply means we're going to have to die to selfishness. We're going to have to die to ourselves. We're going to have to die to sin. But you can boil it all down to one real key issue. Are you willing to die to yourself? It's the hardest, most difficult thing on this earth, but it's the way life is to be lived. You can't get away from it. Now today, will you go away from here today, all of a sudden realizing, you know, the resurrection of Jesus Christ is the most real thing on this earth. It's the most harmonious thing. It blends more with my human existence and my human experience than anything I've ever seen. It does. And so today, on this Lord's Day morning, which 1948 years ago, to this very day, Jesus of Nazareth arose from the dead and brought to life, or to light, life and immortality, and lets us see it full view. Jesus was raised from the dead on this day, this Lord's Day, and we've observed his life, his death, and his resurrection this morning in this supper. Will you observe it in your life? Don't remain like a Tassaday tribesman. Won't you open your eyes and let the resurrection of Jesus Christ empower you through faith to live that new life? Now, if you're not a Christian, I've already told you what's required. The death, the burial, and the resurrection. You'll have to do this in faith, believing that Jesus was also the one who experienced that. And if you'd like to experience it this morning, there are garments prepared. If you'd like to get in tune with the universe, the garments are prepared. If your heart is ready, if it's died, if it is now being buried and you'd like to bury it in water, if you'd like to be raised to walk a new life in tune with the universe, in tune with nature, in tune with Jesus Christ, wouldn't you like to do this? Listen, he's coming again sometime soon. I don't know when. Don't miss him. Won't you come this morning, right now, while we stand and sing?